Welcome to NACSW's Podcast of the Month. Our podcast program makes available recordings of a wide variety of NACSW presentations and discussions on topics of particular interest to Christians in social work. Our Podcast of the Month program features a new podcast every 30 days for your listening pleasure. We hope you enjoy today's podcast.
Our self-image really impacts our self-esteem and our sense of worth and worthiness. Now, we also know, too, that those that have poor self-esteem, you know, this poor self-image may result from accumulated criticisms from childhood, from family systems, and from other sort of resources, such as school teachers. I think perhaps all of us might have memories of those times as we were growing up where there was not that sense of validation, that sense of support, which has an impact on how we view ourselves. Now, we know that in the issue of in the effort of achieving self-worth, you know, that it is and can become a real driving force in our lives. And our concern about our worth and our value is ever present. And as human beings, we yearn to experience high value and worth. And our sense of worth, as we all know, is related to our emotional reactions. Those who have a low sense of self-worth will react differently to life crises and life circumstances as compared to those who may have a higher sense of self-esteem and self-worth. So our sense of worth and value is really tied up to our own psychological survival, to our own sense of human flourishing. I think it's something that we really don't debate. So we talk about a sense of high self-esteem, a sense of high self-image, a sense of high self-worth. We can see that people with high self-esteem feel worthy within themselves and with others. And people with high self-esteem feel good and really positive about key elements, key areas of their lives. And in terms of their emotional life, in terms of their mental life, in terms of their personality, in terms of their relationships. Well, those who have high self-esteem really feel good about themselves, basically. And although it may vacillate, but nonetheless, if that core is there, people will tend to feel rather positive about these key elements of their lives. And people with high self-esteem really display an ability to accept themselves and others. Now, but we also know that, you know, there are people whose self-esteem, whose self-image, whose self-worth is not as high. And because many may suffer from a sense of woundedness, where that woundedness might come from. We talk about attachment issues, a lack of secure attachment. That can contribute to a sense of woundedness, of not feeling worthy and not feeling valued. That contributes to a low self-image, a low self-esteem, a low sense of self-worth. You know, many may suffer from the pains of everyday living, pains of loss, pains of disappointment, pains of discouragement. All of these can contribute to a low sense of self-image, self-esteem, and self-worth. And many people that we may find that we're working with, may suffer from being in families where they did not experience validation, they did not experience love, they did not experience the sense of being protected. And my experience in social work began in the area of child abuse and really encountering families, children who really had that sense of being vulnerable and being subject to all forms of physical, emotional, and sexual abuse. Again, how this impacts how they see themselves and how they feel about themselves and their own sense of self-worth. Now, there are indicators. You can name many other indicators. Those self-esteem are not getting worthy. Those who find themselves comparing themselves with others and always trying to rank themselves and not feeling like they are good enough. That's one indication. Having self-doubts about attaining goals in life. I can achieve. And I feel a sense of frustration. Why have a goal? Why have a sense? That's another indication. Feeling unlovable. Not feeling worthy of love. Another indication. Motivated by the need to fit in, always again kind of comparing oneself to someone else, being on the outside as it were. Another indication, feeling self-conscious and unable to be assertive. talk about loneliness, which can lead to drug and alcohol use and other forms of self-harm. Another indication is a profound sense of alienation, meaninglessness, and despair, and feelings of depression. So there may be many more that we can name. But those who have low self-esteem, you might see these kinds of characteristics in how they move through life. But the key for us as Christians is, with this issue of self-esteem, the question is, who are we? And really, what is our true image? Is our true image impacted by this issue of low self-esteem? We can go to the Bible. There are biblical foundations for addressing our self-image. And one of the key verses in the Bible comes from Genesis, first chapter, verses 26 to 27 and 31. And I'll just read this. And God said, "Let us make mankind in our image, in our likeness, so that they may rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky, over the livestock and all the wild animals, and over all the creatures that move along the ground." So God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. God saw that all he had made, and it was very good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the sixth day. And I give another verse from Psalms 139, verse 14. "I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful, and I know that full well." So when we talk about who are we, what is our image, what is our source of self-worth, our self-esteem, it comes from God. We're creating the image of God. Now, what does that mean? We'll just kind of spend some time talking about what is Imago Dei, bearing the image of God. Imago Dei is the image, shadow, likeness, snapshot, or facsimile of God. What this is that we are not God, but we are of God. There's a clear distinction there. Because many of the New Age thought, you know, this kind of pantheistic kind of view that we are God. But the image of God says that we are not God, but we are of God. And the possibility is that we are, in our essential nature, we mirror the divine. We bear the image of God as his image is imprinted on our souls. Those are key distinctions there. So, without going into all the theology that surrounds us, but we can look at some of the attributes of God and our God-like attitudes that reflect the image of God. One, we are created because God is created. We have the heavens and the earth. We have spiritual attitudes and capacity because God is spirit. The word of God is spirit and in truth. Another thing is we communicate because God communicates. God has communicated to us through his holy word, communication. We are rational and intelligent because God is logos, which means reason. We are relational because God is relational. We talk about the Trinity as the relationship between God, Father, Son, Holy Spirit. And we read in Genesis that it is not good for man to be alone. That we are relational beings because that is the image of God implanted in us. We are moral with a moral concept because God is a moral being. So these six things reflect in part the image of God as is implanted in us. But carrying that a bit further, the idea that humans are created in the image of God implies that all human beings have inherent dignity and worth because God, whose image that we are created, is a personification of worth. In addition to man being created in the image of God, Jesus represents the image of God in man, God in human form. Thus, through Jesus, God elevates the status of human existence, and that the passage of love is the essential component of imago Dei, says love exemplifies the life of Christ. But we know that in the midst of the rubble of our system of fragmented selves and our personal system of worthiness, there remains the fact that we are still valued in the eyes of God. Despite the fact that we go through many changes in life, despite the fact that we talk about man's fallenness or brokenness, that we still are valued in the eyes of God. We cannot be separated by bearing the image of God, even in our brokenness. We talk about the image of God, but we also talk about the fact that the image of God is marred by the effects of our brokenness, our fallenness, because we do suffer from being self-centered, indication of our fallenness. We do suffer from being self-absorbed, an indication of our fallenness. We do become victims of our own self-promoting, our own ego, another indication of our fallenness. And this brokenness, this sense of self, can negatively affect our sense of worthiness, our value, our relational capacity, as well as our capacity for human love. Now, the second one going to that historical and contemporary Christian thinkers have discussed throughout Christian history the extent to which man's brokenness has impaired the image of God with illness and our sense of worthiness. You can look at St. Augustine, you can look at Luther, you can look at Calvin, you can look at Bart, you can look at Tilly, you can look at one of my contemporary theological mentors, Martin Luther King, who talk about to what extent have, because of our fallenness, have our sense of the image of God been impaired. But our particular premise is that there continues to be the reality and tension experienced by each of us as we struggle with our fallen nature and our worth and value as a child of God. Our brokenness discards our God-given attributes such as our creativity, our spiritual aptitudes, our capacity to communicate, our rationality, our ability to debate lovingly, and our moral nature. And it is in these domains, areas of brokenness, that appears in our offices as social workers. People who come to us are people that experience brokenness along these various areas. And they are manifested in areas of personal, interpersonal, and family difficulties that we see as clinical problems. But these distortions and brokenness also impair and start one sense of self-worth and self-esteem. Clients who come to us with their brokenness, you can see behind that how this impacts their ability to honor themselves, feel a sense of self-worth and self-esteem. But in affirming one's place in the world as a child of God, made in the image of God, is to affirm one's sense of self-worth or somebody-ness. And this is a term that King uses. Dr. King talks about, in spite of all the places we've gone to, we are still somebody, image of God. And the somebody-ness, our essential worth, is never impaired, is ever present, and it is a gift of grace. So, giving attention to the restoration of self-worth and self-esteem, we as social workers can contribute to the healing of the broken self and broken relationships. And this is a question of how might family therapy restore a sense of worthiness? I'd like to call forth my wife.
Familiar with the works of Virginia Satir, communications and therapist. We looked at her works as being very consistent with the idea of imago Dei, in that if you know anything about Virginia Satir, you know that her primary philosophical value assumption is that if the family does nothing else, they will teach their children to respect themselves, respect others, and instill a sense of self-worth. And as a Christian, I feel that the most important thing that they do is to teach their children to love and serve the Lord. Only second to that is protecting their children. But respect for the individual, self-esteem as being a family function, okay? One of the philosophical underpinnings is that the individual is always in touch with their growth potential, and self-help and self-discovery is a part of a nurturing environment. In that, if you think about the social problems we have. Think about substance abuse, domestic violence. We have crime, gangs. Think about the dynamics of that. If I were, as a family therapist, let's say if God were to fill our water system with a potion that instilled everyone to have a really high sense of self-esteem and self-worth, and they woke up feeling great about themselves, respecting themselves, respecting their body, their mind, their soul, and respecting others. Think about the dynamics of how that will impact crime, gangs, respecting other people, not to impose crime on each other, respecting families so that the gangs do not replace the family and the family functioning, respecting your body so that you are not abusing your body with substance abuse, respecting others so that domestic violence is not a part of the family dynamic. So self-respect for each other and instilling self-esteem is, as Virginia Satir sees it, as a primary function of the families. The other piece is that, and it's a very strength perspective, is that, again, she feels that people are born with, I think it's a very sacred thought, that people are born with the potential to get in touch with who they are, to become people who are able to help themselves. Therapist beliefs as an important tool. I'm not talking about the notion or phenomenon that what we do as therapists is effective. That's important. All research shows that if you don't believe that what you're doing is going to help, it's probably not going to help. But what I'm really talking about is your belief in that families and the individuals and families are created in the image of God. And that because of that, your belief is that everyone that you see is intrinsically have value and self-worth. And how does that happen? This model feels that how it happens is through communication. How families communicate with each other helps. In the postmodern thought, it talks about the power of language, the power of the word. And so dysfunctional communication is indirect, it's unclear, it's vague, it's dishonest, it's distorted, and it's incomplete. On the other hand, highly functioning families have clear, complete, congruent, and we'll talk a little bit about congruent momentarily, communication. And nurturing highly functional families nurture their each other. They nurture a sense of high self-esteem, and conversely, their communication is good. The other piece about communication is the whole notion of the roles and rules that families have to govern their process. If you think about all of the implicit and explicit rules that govern family process, it would take me all day and I still wouldn't be finished to thinking about from when you get up in the morning, what's the rule about, you know, who goes first in the bathroom and what you do before breakfast and you have breakfast and you sit down together and you speak and you get what I'm saying, all the rules and roles that families have. And so within this model, the assumption is that families where there is low self-esteem of its members influence and create poor coping. And that poor coping then creates families presenting problems. So the low self-esteem influencing coping ability and coping ability influencing families presenting problems. So let's talk about one of the key elements of the communications framework is the four dysfunctional communication stances or four roles. Not too long ago, I looked in a family therapy casebook, and it had a movie, The Great Santini, and I was like, wow, this is amazing, because that movie is really old. How many are familiar with The Great Santini?
Books. Do I really
want to
say this?
Reveal your
age. It really is. I mean, I know it, so. And the reason why I think that they would put this in, and this is a recent family therapy book, is not because the plot is so intriguing, but because the main focus of that film is family dynamics and family process, and it's so rich. So let me just give you a little background on the Great Santini. That's what they call the father. He's a colonel, and they call him Bull, and you'll see why. And there's a wife, Lillian, and then there are three children, Matt, the eldest, then Marianne, all four, then Ben, who's about 7 or 8, and then, I think it's 3. So, with that, we have Matt, who's like 17, turning 18 in the movie, and Marianne is just under him, probably 16. And they focus more on Ben and Marianne. You don't know much about the other kids. So, dysfunctional communication, the dynamics behind that is that it really is a mechanism where people hide their feelings of low self-esteem. That it essentially illustrates and is a product of people not feeling good about themselves. And dysfunctional communication stances also talk about families' members and their various roles. So, placator. Lillian is the mother. And you would see Lillian is that her, she was a communication blocker. Because when something happened in the family, she would run to them, and when the father would do something, no matter how outrageous it was, and he did some really outrageous things, she would run to them and interpret, you know, you have to learn your father's signals, you know, he he doesn't mean it this way, he loves you. And the reason why I'm saying blocking communication, because it's preventing them from working things out together without a third person so directly. So it's almost like that placator person is so, the self-esteem is so low that it's like their emotional survival depends on it. That a big part of what they do is pleasing others and often engaging in apologetic, tentative, and self-effacing communication. So they feel that they need to please others, and that will help them to avoid rejection, which is primary to what this dynamic is about. And so when we think about families function in terms of from a Christian point of view, is helping families to think about that they are worthy inherently because they are created in the image of God. Then we have the blamer. The father, Bull Colonel, was the blamer. He attempted to control others. He ruled what was being made for dinner. He dictated what Lillian, the mother, made for dinner. He engaged in behaviors that were really outrageous. There were a couple scenes. One scene when he was playing against Ben, the 17-year-old turning 18. And like fathers who play with their kids, there's going to be a time when the kids are going to finally meet you. And so that was the time. They were playing basketball one-on-one, and finally Ben beat the father in basketball one-on-one. And so in order not to lose, he changed the rules of the game. So, which then caused him to have another chance to win, and then he did win. And another situation was that Ben was also a very good varsity basketball player. And one of the instructions, I think they were about to lose, or they needed something good to happen. And the father instructed his son to not just commit a foul, but take him down to physically hurt the other player. And the son did not want to do that, and so he had a moral crisis. So I just wanted to give you a sense of the father controlling the mother, everyone in the family. And so, again, the dynamics of the blamer is it's fault-finding, name-calling, criticism. That will pretty much capture the kernel, don't you think? And basically, not the one up, one down. You can't feel good about yourself unless you put someone down. So that's the dynamic behind the blamer. Then we have the super reasonable. That is the person who attempts to anesthetize and insulate from their true feelings. That is, their response to family conflict is often an intellectual or overly rational one, because what's happening is that they're wanting to bypass that emotional inner self. They create the aura of non-involvement, but emotionally they still are being impacted, but they are struggling not to be a part of family dynamics. So their inner feelings are downplayed and avoided. And basically trying to create an environment where other members do the same. And so the end result of that is that it is impedes, interferes with open and honest communication. Irrelevant. This is a really interesting role. I would say the daughter, Marianne, who is 16, she would take on the role of the irrelevant. One thing that dynamic in the family is that I think women weren't highly valued in the family. And so you would pretty much be safe to call bull a sexist. That only the men, the Meacham family, are. And so Marianne once said, can only men be real Meachams? And Marianne felt marginalized as a result of one, Bull's, the colonel's disengagement from the family, but also feeling uncared for, and she felt alienated from the family. There was one scene where she was in one of the scenes, talk about control. They had a prom, and the father made them go together. They couldn't go with other people to the prom. And so dating was pretty much a taboo in the household. And she said once, Dad, can girls ever be real Meachams? And he looked at her really, leave me alone. And then she said, I just want you to know I'm getting married. And who she said she was marrying pretty much violated every bias and prejudice and stereotype that the father had. And she said that he was a midget, he was homosexual, he was black, and she just went on to everything that would touch his buttons, and so he knew that. But it's kind of, again, the irrelevant person role is attempting to refocus that family communication elsewhere. It's almost like a tension reliever, that when the tension gets too high, that person takes on the role of kind of like lowering the thermostat, if you will. But again, it's kind of like if someone talks in the family and walked up to someone else and they said, I'm doing this and that, and then you change the subject and saying, well, how's your mother? You know, it's that kind of change in communication where it's like let me give you another example. I admitted in this meeting at the faculty, that small meeting that we were having, that there was a lot of tension and conflict. And we were in someone's office, and they had a bowl of candy. And it was really good candy. It really was hard candy. And so they were talking. It was real heated. And I picked up the candy, and I said, wow, this candy is really good, especially the one in the orange wrapper. And I said, oops, I'm engaging as the irrelevant child in the family. And they cracked up. And it did relieve the tension because people were at each other's throat. But that's an example of irrelevant ruffle and me commenting on the candy. Okay, incongruent communication. Let me see how much time I have. What do we have? 15? Okay. Hold on, let me see.
I'll flag you when you've got 5 minutes left. That's part of my job.
That's part of your job.
Okay. Let me go through these slides quickly. Incongruent communication, being the verbal doesn't match the nonverbal. Contradictory messages. Messages are distorted. And the bottom line is, the family member doesn't know, they're confused, they're conflicted, they're hurt. They don't really know what it is you want them to do. Metacommunication, that's the message behind the message. You already know that, but essentially within families, we think about families having that intended message, but it's not being communicated. Double bind messages, as I have here at the bottom, it's a catch-22. You're damned if you do and damned if you don't. That regardless of how you respond, you're not going to please that person, and you're going to be punished in the sense of however the family reprimands you. Family rules and roles. Again, central to the understanding of family pathology and dysfunctioning is the notion that family rules and roles can be passed down through generations, and that our family of origin influences us to either be very much like the environment we were in, or swearing to be the exact opposite. I'm never going to be like that. I'm going to be different. So healthy, functional family rules and roles are clear, flexible, and adaptive to the environment, and particularly the changing developmental needs. And that's especially important when we think about the rules needing to change and how we react to and talk to our children as they move through the different stages. Family myths and secrets. It's important that within the work with our families, that we help them become aware of what the myths and secrets are, and to bring it out in the open. And I'll finish with the role of the therapist. As you can see, within a communications framework, you're not a neutral person. You are helping people to realize their own potential. You facilitate healthy communication in how they speak to one another. Even when you move on to whatever the presenting problem is, you still help them pay attention to and stay focused on how it's communicated. So even when you move to the content, you still have that third eye and help families to, you know, facilitate good communication. So you keep an eye on while you're dealing with content, you also deal with the process. And then as a therapist, creating the environment within the therapy, being a good role model for communication, mediating to families when they have communication impasses, and then being a teacher and educator to help families see new solutions for old problems and new ways of coping with. So, therapeutic tools and techniques. I'm going to stop here, I just pulled out a few, but she has many rules, therapeutic tools and techniques that are work very well to the degree that they've been used in other models. So family sculpting, where you sculpt families' view of themselves within the family, so that they can comment and others can comment on how they see themselves and the dynamics, the communication stances, helping them to, it's an extension of sculpting where they communicate how they feel or what the roles are. The reframing, that's been a pretty, and relabeling, very important tool and technique in many other family therapy models. And the notion of humor and touch. And that is humor to kind of break the ice and touch, showing kindness and care for the individual members. So I want to stop now because I wanted to leave some time for dialogue. So how much time do we have?
15 minutes.
Okay, wonderful. All right. So, I guess I want to stop at this point to entertain any questions and to talk about talk about the case.
Is meta communication
the same as covert communication? I've heard the term meta, but I never quite figured out what that meant.
It's like you may have a conversation and the content of the conversation, what you actually say, that there's really a larger message. It's like the bottom line. It's the message behind the message. It's what really is going on.
So covert?
Covert communication. We talk more about that when we talk about incongruent messages. That is, what is actually said versus what the nonverbal behavior is. So when we talk about them not matching, that say an example is the perennial mother-in-law coming to visit, right? And so the verbal and nonverbal not matching would be something that you would help the families address. So the reaction might be, oh, your mother's coming to visit. Oh, your mother's coming to visit. Oh, your mother's coming to visit. I said the same thing, right? But my nonverbal is not matching my verbal. And that's the incongruent message. But I think kind of crossing with that is within that message, within that incongruent message, the meta communication is, are the dynamics behind what, how do I really feel about it? Oh, your mother's coming to visit. What the words are just acknowledging what you said, the event, but the meta communication is, there's some issues. I have some issues.
There's a story behind the incongruence.
Story behind.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about maybe working with ethnic families, such as African American families, or just families of different cultures, how this, does this apply across the board, and would your skills of working with families be different, and how would it look particularly?
One of the things that we wrote a textbook on family therapy with ethnic minorities. We use that term because that's the best we can figure out. We don't particularly like the term minority, but ethnic groups, but you know what I mean, African American, Asian, Latino, and Native American, or First Nations peoples. And the larger approach that we feel like people need to think about is, as we say, not to throw the baby out with the bathwater. That's what the old folks, a Southern example, saying is. And that is that you need to be careful how you apply certain values and tools and techniques and your understanding and assessment of the ways that family communicate. And so within the family roles, for instance, it's important not to impose your own values of the husband and the wife's role. That, for instance, I always say as a rule of thumb that if it works for them, it's functional, and functional meaning that there isn't violence in the family, that they're able to move through life, that if the roles work for them, then they work for them. And it's important not to impose your own thinking about the role of the male and the female with each other, you know, being egalitarian or one being more dominant or certain areas taking the lead in certain areas of family function.
Here's a comment too, you know, and it's not just this particular theory, but sometimes there are cultural biases in clinical theories. For example, you know, some clinical theories talk about individuation, self-actualization, which may fly in the face of certain cultural perspectives, which may be much more collective, much more family-centered. So I think, you know, there are certain theories that are kind of individualistic in their orientation or their premise, but others really honor the collectiveness and maybe more congruent with a cultural perspective. So I think, you know, you look at Bowen's theory, for example, which talks about self-differentiation, which may have a very Western, individualistic kind of orientation. And so we have to be kind of cautious in terms of how there may be certain biases in theoretical models that may fly in the face of a cultural framework about how families should operate. Does that make sense?
Because I was in a previous workshop and I made the comment about educating parents when they're relating with their kids to not use shaming as a pretty regular mechanism, because that decreases their self-esteem and image, you know, their child of God. And when they get older, there's, you know, the family's not the resource, and so there's all this pathology and, you know, dysfunction. And, you know, then we have to help them at the back end of that. And so I was talking about, you know, addressing the problem as an educator, educating parents on not shaming the children.
Right, right.
But that seemed to step on a couple of the ladies' toes about, well, this is our culture and we love our kids and this is why we do it. And so it was like, okay, you don't know what it's like.
You know, I hear you, and I hear that a lot, especially in our consultations. And one of the things I always say, two things to do. One is, when you're not sure, is to get a cultural consultant to get a sense of what actually, is there a distortion of the culture, or the culture in service of, as they say, a defense mechanism. And then the other piece, again, is not to romanticize the culture. That is, everything about culture is good and healthy. You know, all of our cultures have dark sides. We have pieces that don't work for the family. They're cultural and they don't work. You know, for instance, there was a while that in African American families, their corporal punishment was how the approach to discipline. And as things evolved and studies evolved, that some of the premier black African-American psychologists and psychiatrists did studies, and they said, you know what, folks, this doesn't work. It's harmful, and it's not even effective. And so that was a paradigm shift, if you will, but I ran across people, parents, who would say, you know, you of all people should know, you know, that, you know, we whip our children and this is, you know, and this is what black people do. And so I would say, even if I wasn't African American, that you could use, you know, it's like hiding behind, you know, having a cultural consultant to step up and say, you know, this is a distortion of the culture.
Yeah.
And the culture has evolved.
You talk about shaming, though. I was thinking back to my times in high school as a so-called athlete. I say so-called. You know, I was more of a bench warmer than on the floor. But I remember, though, the strategy of the coaches, you know, where they kind of shame you to make you perform better. Not feel better, but to perform better. And sometimes shame is used to make a person perform better, but again, your own sense of self-worth may be fractured by that. So I just kind of thought about that, you know, one experience in particular, which I won't go into.
Who was the, therapist that y'all got a lot of this work from? Like, I need to get her your name now.
Virginia Satir. Was one of the, you know, historical family therapists, but the only social worker among the early family therapists. And for that reason, in some ways, you know, she has been, but not given the primary accolades as the physician, such as Bowman, such as Mnuchin, kind of put on the periphery of things.
I just want to say a question, like, kind of going off of her question about, like, the culture. Like, have y'all found, like, the idea of, like, dysfunctional communication stance? Like, are those cross culture, or like is it, are there certain instances where it doesn't, where like these don't play out? Have you seen this at all?
When you say play out, you mean?
Like, I'm guessing, like, for example, I know that, like, in my culture, being, you know, white, I see these inside of my family. Like, mm-hmm. This is, like, some of my families play out in front of me. But, like, in African-American, Asian, other cultures, like, do these stances play out? So, like, is this cross-culture, or is this just specific to one?
Yeah, you find the placator, the blamer, the super-reasonable, the irrelevant. It may come out in different kinds of ways, but you find those kinds of stances apparent in another cultural framework.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You mentioned an interesting term, a cultural consultant. Do you actually have a Rolodex of people that, I'm trying to think practically, some of us work, you know, if you work in inner city New York, some of the public school systems have, you know, dozens, sometimes hundreds of cultures and languages. Is that something that we need to consider doing, is to begin making connections with folks who can help us access folks from very cultures so different than our own?
Yeah, I feel like it's advocating for your client. That is, if you don't have the consultant, that cultural expert within the agency setting,
right,
that you advocate that they have someone that you can talk to, consult with, just like they would have an expert on, you know, some PTSD,
right,
or an expert on psychopharmacology to elevate the importance of that cultural understanding.
Strikes me to be a really fruitful way for social workers to network with each other. Because from time to time, someone will ask me for a consult on a Christian client, particularly if they're from a Christian tradition that the practitioner doesn't know a lot about. But at the same time, there's all kinds of ways in which I could use probably that person's expertise. But it'd be interesting to see if trying to develop cultural and religious list of folks who are competent that could give you some, what in the world do they mean when they talk about God told me this? If they really think God told them that, what does that mean? What do I do with that? And that might be the service we can provide for each other.
Yeah, good point.
Another piece to, I think, sometimes we can use families as cultural informants as well.
Yeah.
So I think you have to recognize the fact that even there are some within cultural differences, because, you know, there's some broader cultural things, but their own particular family style in terms of how they operationalize those cultural variables are important as well. But sometimes those family members can be cultural informants.
Right.
Not just a different bit of, you know, different than consultants per se, but informants as well. Give you their kind of stance on how they actualize, how they operationalize their own cultural perspective.
And even to that end, I think about an expression that my mother used. The function of it was to give a powerful message that reverberated in the family without her saying it. And she said, "I put it where people can get it." You ever heard that expression? I don't know if she made that up or what. But what she meant was that she strategically told people in the family who have positions of power, you know, her opinion about how things should go. And that was her way of being heard, that she put it where people can get it.
I think, you know, in organizations, we may do that kind of unconsciously. We want things to be conveyed to someone so we don't tell them directly, but we know we plan it. And we know that given the communication channels in that structure, it's going to get to them.
No different than junior high when we have a crush on someone. We know we're not going to tell them directly, but we know who to tell.
There you go.
I've got children that do.
Any other questions? So just to,
No, I'm just scratching.
That's that clinician in me. It's like, I'm going to say something.
When you have a class, don't move.
So just to, you know, to emphasize the whole notion of Imago Dei, that you really believe that your families are in the image of God, and they are intrinsically worthy of your serving them with grace.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for joining us today for NACSW's Podcast of the Month featured selection. We hope you found today's session useful and that it will support your efforts to thoughtfully integrate Christian faith and social work practice. We also hope that you will consider participating in additional NACSW's activities and events, including NACSW's upcoming convention in the fall, our quarterly audio conference workshops that we offer at no cost to NACSW members, and which includes free CEUs accredited by the Association of Social Work Boards, our online continuing education program, and access to dozens of archived podcasts from the members section of our website. Also, we invite you to join NACSW's Facebook group or our Facebook fan page. For additional information about these and other NACSW benefits and services, you can go to our website at www.nacsw.org. Thanks again for listening in today to our podcast session today.